And we're back. This is David Wilner.
And Brandon Levy-Seliva.
You're listening to The Landmine Show.
Brought to you by Foundation Stone.
Our third installment here of a very informative and eye-opening discussion regarding literacy in ancient Israel. Barnea, who's our guest?
Professor Aaron Dembski of Bar-Ilan University from the Department of Jewish History has just published a book on literacy in ancient Israel. And boy, are we having a discussion. Barnea, hang in there. And it's so appropriate to have this now because we're almost
happening at
Shavuot, which is the time of the giving of the Torah and learning. What a great week to have this discussion.
But you know what I find happening? I find what's happening is that we want hard and fast answers, and he's being a very careful scientist. And I respect that so much. I'm not going to run down the speculation road. I'm going to stick to what I know and what I can show and what I can demonstrate. And I think that's fantastic. Your book is not yet in English. Are there plans to publish this book in English?
It's possible.
So it's a weighty book, as Barnea was mentioning a short while ago. It's a challenge because I think every paragraph has something that you got to stop and you got to chew on. And I think that's great. I've also been going through recently Christopher Rolston's book. He just published or recently published a book on epigraphy as well. And I have to say, every time I turn a page in both of these books, to be fair, it elucidates. I would say it draws out for me 100 questions. And I think part of the challenge of looking back historically is not putting our own cultural preconceptions on what life was like and being able to say, okay, what does the record show? And the further back you go in history, the less the historical record has to say, the less we have. I mean, there's a dearth of archaeological evidence, and as Barnea was pointing out, that much ancient writing was just not preserved. We just don't have it. So we have to infer from the historical record, from the biblical record, from whatever pieces we can cobble together and try to paint a picture that allows us to understand to some degree what those times were like. So I'd like to put the mic back in your hands, right? What can we now do? What can we look at? And we started with this question. I think we're still there to some degree. And you gave some wonderful examples that indicate the interrelationship both between the written word and the verbal expression of that written word. We have it in a tradition. The Maimonides points this out. And we have an oral Torah and we have a written Torah. But on top of that, when a student sat in a classroom, and the Maimonides makes this point, you could take copious notes, as many notes as you want from your teacher, but the process of transmission of our tradition is from mouth to ear. And so as much as writing is valued, so is the sharing of that information, which is very human. We want to be able to say, what can we look at historically? What can we look at in the past that could tell us about how literate people were? And you've made, I think, the very strong case for there's no way to really know how literate the site in terms of percentages. But there are indications, and there is a picture painted for a literate society. What are the implications of a literate society?
I think you've put your finger on the question that one that calls for a certain methodology. The question of literacy is not only the technology of writing reflected in epigraphy, in the study of epigraphy, but also the cultural implications of writing and the overall impression that we're looking at a literate society, or one at least that we read through the Bible and through the extra-biblical documents, which is written evidence. I, as a cultural historian, trying to understand the multifaceted aspects of literacy from a social perspective, from a cultural perspective, which includes religion, the history of religion as well, idea of revelation and how revelation is presented in the Bible in a literary form, in the form of covenant, of a written covenant, a form of two tablets that are inscribed by God. These are expressions that reflect a literate point of view, that reflect the an aspect and the impact of writing. My question that you asked before, Barnea, regarding method, regarding the discussion today, the contemporary discussion, the tibi or courant in biblical history, what are the methods that you use? And what we're looking at, with all due respect to my colleagues who are archaeologists, the discussion of history of the biblical period, or the cultural history of the biblical period, has been taken over by archaeologists who, from their own specific aspect of research, of hard evidence, of material culture, have come to answer questions that are basically not hard culture, not hard evidence, not archaeological evidence alone, but are more cultural aspects particularly of ancient Israel. So that when we look at the low chronologists and the high chronologists, it's a discussion between one branch of research regarding antiquity, between two groups that are basically playing on the same ball field. Whereas I come and say, now look, there are other aspects. If you want to understand literacy in ancient Israel, you must contend with the biblical text. You must contend with contemporary society. You must look at Mesopotamia and Egypt and see what they're writing and how they're writing and what their institutions are for education. So that, as you know in my introduction, I try to look at various approaches to the question of literacy in ancient Israel, particularly literary approach. The fact that we're looking at a national literature in the Bible, which again is an innovation. Prior to that, we read stories about Ugarit and the Ugaritic gods, about the Mesopotamian gods, the Egyptian gods. And that literature tells us that's mythology. It comes to tell us about their gods. Whereas the innovation here is national literature, where the literature is the Bible, is written for and about the people of Israel. Now, God does take a position. God is a player in history, according to the Bible. And that's very important because, in a sense, the Bible is religious literature. It takes the place of mythology. It tells how God interacts with mankind, and in that way, we can understand God better in a religious direction that does not speak in mythological terms. That has to be taken into consideration. The aspect of education, the history of education, is an aspect of learning how to study literacy in the ancient world and particularly in Israel. And so that one has to bring that to the table as well. Now, one has to bring epigraphy to the table. That's obvious, because epigraphy is an important aspect. That's the hard evidence, but it's not the only evidence. There also has to be comparative studies. I mentioned before about Greece in the Archaic period, Greece in the Classical period, and here we have an example of a society that becomes literate in the light of history. So that,
what do you mean?
I mean that the Greeks, as everybody knows, were influenced by the Canaanites. And so that the Greek alphabet has its roots in Canaanite society. Now, whether you will go as far back as Nava and say it's in the 1100s, or as Zass would put it, around 800 or 750, whatever that is, what you do see is the contact with the Canaanite world. Now, if you look at it from a Greek point of view, a Greek scholarship, then you say one scholar says it was Palmyris who, according to a Greek legend, created the alphabet in order to write down Homer. So what we're looking at in the Greek world is the transition from an illiterate society into a literate society. So this has to be taken into consideration when we make
it. I just have to laugh because my kids were struggling in school learning how to read. And it wasn't Homer, it was Harry Potter. And this phenomenon happened when Harry Potter came out. All over the world, children's literacy rose dramatically because they wanted to read it. They advanced two grades in the space of a month or two that the school. So it's not that I, when I first heard that in the history lesson, I said, because they wanted to read Homer. No, I can only enter that epic world if I can read. I got to learn how to, it just picked everybody up. Just an example in our time.
Right, that's right. So in other words, when I attempt to appreciate literacy in ancient Israel, I try to bring to the table different aspects of research and how we look at the documents and appreciate them and understand the development. Of course, it's not simple, and it's not a simple question. It's not something that can be answered only archaeologically.
No, this book is the equivalent of a trigger film. A trigger film is to get the conversation going. I'm sorry, let me to cheapen the day. David, I'm sorry. I mean that. Oh, now that you've, I hope conclusively, but this is now open for peer review. It's been available now for 6 weeks. By the way, I met some people who bought it on the day it hit Stymatsky's bookstore because they had to read it. But now that you're introducing these elements in the conversation, everyone should go and reassess. Maybe I disagree that this element shouldn't be. Maybe I think I have the right to stay within this world without dealing with that. But you've broadened the playing field and the conversation should broaden. You were mentioning the idea of a conference just on this. I would strongly support that there should be at least a day conference where people who have what to say on this topic have a chance to speak to their peers in academia and open up for public discussion. And my sense is a lot of the elements that you're bringing in here and the analysis of how a society works and what I could draw out of context, I haven't heard neither in the media that everybody's reading, which I track probably more than other people, and I haven't heard in class as much. It's really an incredible level of analysis of the words and of the background, but without this piece. You had a question about the geography.
I was just going to get back to that.
Excellent.
Issue. We have an ancient world, and we have writing in Egypt, as you've mentioned, and we have writing in Mesopotamia, and they're two different systems.
And in the Indus Valley and in China.
But I'm talking about this particular corner of the planet.
Okay.
And in between these two great empires, we have the Canaanite world, for lack of a more specific term. And an alphabetic writing develops there. Is it reactionary? Is it something independent in your view? And can we chart it as it develops and spreads and expands its range?
Geographically.
Yeah. What was the trigger here of the formation of the alphabet? Well, first of all, we're looking at something that's not a simple evolution of earliest scripts. The earliest scripts are what are called logosyllabic scripts, which are much more involved and are good for people who want to sit and study for 20 years to learn how to read and write. What you have here is a quick system. You have here a revolution, as I said in the course's terms, of thinking, of technology, of abstraction, a Canaanite scribe, who was familiar with Egyptian, came up with the brilliant idea that everything could be reduced, that writing could be reduced to a system of sounds, of phonemes, of consonants, and in doing so, in reflecting on his own Canaanite language, came up with some 20 to 30 signs, and then gave each one its form, very basic, and then each one he gave a name on the basis of an acrophonic system, which is the first letter or sound of a word, a simple word. So if it was Alf, it was a bull, a bull's head or an ox's head. A be was a bayit or a bet, and so on down the line. And then he joined them in an order. And one of the amazing things from a cultural point of view, that order, which is first attested, first documented about 1400 BCE in Ugarit with a 30-letter alphabet, later reduced to 22-letter Canaanite alphabet, whatever the case, that basic form has been maintained right down to the present, so that we're still talking about an alphabet, we're talking about an aleph bet, we're talking about the order is basically there. So that's a great innovation and something that shaped alphabetic thinking and alphabetic writing and what I think also is literate societies.
And this now, unknown person, to me, is a genius.
He was, definitely.
He was like off the charts.
Right,
yeah.
Right. He thought abstractly and came up with this system. What was his motivation? Just as we don't know anything about him and no biography, we don't know what his motivation was.
I just want to say Ataturk made a decision. I'm going to change the alphabet that the people are going to use. I'm going to create a unified field, answered various questions with his team of experts, and promoted literacy and created a culture just based on what alphabet we're going to use. That's so much on a smaller scale than what we're talking about, you know, but He just forged.
Yeah, but there was also different motivations there as well. He was breaking with the Islamic world, and he was joining the European
world. Absolutely, but
world.
Just saying here within the past century, you saw a person use letters to form a society.
I just want you to understand, Barnea, that Ataturk is coming out of 3,000 years.
Yeah, absolutely, it's on a very small scale.
Tradition.
I accept that.
Okay.
Getting back now to the what we're talking about is the early history of the alphabet. What we're talking about is the second millennium. So with the invention of the alphabet, which is roughly around 1800 BCE, until its standardization, which comes in around 1200 BCE with the Iron Age, standardization, I mean, the direction of writing, the stance of the letters, the solidification of the order of the letters, all of this took about 500 years in development. In those 500 years, we're looking also at the geographic spread of the alphabet. The question that you asked, where is it going and how is it developing? Well, there's a great deal of experimentalization during this period, so that we find the Proto-Sinaitic script, we find the Proto-Canaanite script, so-called Proto-Canaanite script.
Southern Arabian.
Now, that's the next point. We also find in the 13th century, 12th century, a document at Beit Shemesh. It was discovered in Beit Shemesh. That was written in cuneiform alphabet. That cuneiform alphabet is again another development, and that's characteristic of the writing at Ugarit. So here again, you're looking at an alphabetic principle in a cuneiform garb, in a cuneiform dress. Now this was important for Ugarit. Why? Because Ugarit was part of the literate world of ancient Mesopotamia, and so they chose to write the alphabet, their alphabet, or the old Canaanite or early West Semitic alphabet, in cuneiform, so that it wouldn't look
strange. Which
previously
had been hundreds of letters, but they can recognize this style.
Right, but parallel, they still continue in their hundreds of signs. But what we're looking at is a particular attempt to adjust alphabetic principle, local alphabetic principle, to the greater literary world.
But it's essentially a developmental dead end.
Well, not necessarily. It was a dead end because that's, the society's folded for other reasons. But what we have here is what I mentioned is the cuneiform from Beit Shemesh. Now, about 20 years ago, a Russian Jewish scholar in London discovered that this is basically the order of the alphabet of the South Arabian alphabet. Now, that is about 22 letters. 29 letters. And that alphabet was used in South Arabia. It's known from the 6th century BCE. So, and then afterwards, it goes on to Ethiopia, the Ethiopian alphabet. Now, this alphabet is a different order than the Aleph Bet. It starts Hey, Lamed, Chet, Mem. It's called the Halakham order. And so what we can assume is that this Halakham order that was seen late in the 6th century or so in South Arabia is now projected back with two examples, one in Beit Shemesh and the other one at Ugarit, the Halakham order, which indicates that there was an alternative system of writing the alphabet in the second millennium. Now, this system was rejected in the Canaanite world and was moved out to the periphery and wound up some 600 years later in South Arabia. So again, it shows us some of the inner tension and development process and the geography of what is going on. Now, what you see again, whether when the Greeks adopted the alphabet, probably because the Phoenicians, and particularly those in Byblos, exported papyrus to the Greeks, they probably exported not only the material goods, the papyrus, but showed the Greeks what to do with the papyrus besides making baskets and boats.
I would just suggest the modern business example. Yes. There's various companies. Walmart did this. Others. If you want to work with us, we have found this method to be most efficient. Mm-hmm. And you have to work with us this way. This is how we want record keeping. That's what you do. So you want us to export and trade. And Aaron Mayer, Justin Telesafi, mm-hmm. your colleague in Bar-Ilan, is showing the extent of that trade. You must function with us in a system. We're not going to change. If you don't know how to use a typewriter, don't work with us. If you can't use a telex, don't work with us. This is how we keep records to know if our shipment made, did you pay or do you not. It's money. I'll accept it pretty quick.
Very good. And that's why the Greeks called that book that they were writing now, the Biblia, from Byblos, the product of Byblos.
So we're at the end of our third segment. We're going to stop you right here.
You're throwing the book at us.
That's it. We're talking with Professor Aaron Dembski. We're talking about literacy in ancient Israel.
And his new book from the Bialik Institute.
And we want to invite you back after the break. This is David Wilner.
And Bernie Levy-Sullivan.
You're listening to The Landmines Show.
Brought to you by Foundation Stone.